If We Burn is a book about mass protest. And my relationship to that topic is personal. In a way, it sort of chose me and not choose it. A little over 10 years ago, in June 2013, I was working as a correspondent in Sao Paulo, the largest city in South America, when a group of leftists and anarchists began to organize a set of protests against the rise in the price of the bus fare in the city. This group, the MPL, or the Movimento Passe Livre, the Free Fare Movement, had been doing this for 8 years. Their long-term goal was the full decommodification of public transportation in Brazil. But whenever there was a rise in the concrete price of existing transportation, they would take to the streets and put together very raucous, very combative, prefigurative, direct actions meant to not only sort of make it actually free for a few hours to take public transportation in Brazil, so they would block turnstiles, but to force the government to reverse the price hike. And after four of these protests, which were quite effective at bringing parts of the city to a standstill, but not effective yet at getting the rest of the country on side, at the very least, they were not effective yet at getting the mainstream media in the country on side, at getting the largest, most powerful voices in the country to be sympathetic to the movement. On the morning of June 13th, 2013, the media in Brazil, which is largely owned by oligarchs and right-leaning, called for a crackdown on this protest movement. And if the class of journalists in Brazil came from the same parts of Brazilian society that usually experience repression at the hands of the military police, and the military police in Brazil, of course, is a legacy of the US-backed dictatorship, which started in 1964. If Brazilian journalists were from the class that usually experience repression at the hands of the military police, they would have known what was coming when you asked them to crack down on a group of punks and anarchists. But they did not, and when the crackdown came, it shocked them and shocked the country. So very quickly afterwards, you get a complete flip in mainstream media coverage of this protest movement. The group of people in the country with the biggest microphones switched from saying on the morning of June 13th, this is a group of punks that we need to clear out the streets so society can get back to business as usual, to by the night of June 13th saying, no, this is a great thing. This is a patriotic uprising in defense of the right to rise up in defense of something. Because they didn't really actually know what to say about why it was good. They just knew that the crackdown had shocked them. Public sympathy had flipped. Their sympathy had flipped. What matters quite a lot in the story, that people liked me. I wasn't one of the ones that went viral for being repressed, but journalists at mainstream outlets in Brazil were repressed. But this script totally flipped, and the reasons for why the protests were good totally different, because the mainstream media in Brazil were never going to say, it's good to do punk anarchist-style direct action to call for the full commodification of transportation. They couldn't actually just reproduce the narrative that would have been put forward by the MPL, the original organizers. They had to come up with something else. So as many more people come into the streets a few days later, these new people come into the streets with new ideas as to what the protest is, and a lot happens in the week from June 13th to June 20th, but suffice to say that these new arrivals come into initially verbal and then ultimately physical confrontation with the original organizers, and by June 20th, what we would now recognize as the beginning of a far-right movement in Brazil, physically remove some of the leftists from the streets, some of the Trotskyist parties, some of the smaller left parties, some of the original punks and anarchists are actually thrown out of the streets from the movement that they had started just weeks earlier. And then, in that weird ball of energy unleashed on the streets of Brazil in June 2013, groups are born, which, over the next few years, play a much larger role in Brazilian politics than the original organizers of the June 2013 protests that they pretend to be, that they intentionally copy. And movements born in this cauldron of activism and street action go on to successfully call for the removal of democratically elected left of center President Dilma Rousseff, the first woman president in Brazilian history, a former Marxist guerrilla, and then campaign for the election of Jair Bolsonaro in 2018, and then are elected with him and enter into government in 2019. So living through all this strange 5-6 year period, it seems that at the beginning of June 2013, the Brazilian people asked for something and they got the exact opposite. It seems that, however you really wanted to read the streets of June 2013, it started about better public services and in opposition to police brutality, and then you get a government which proudly destroys public services and celebrates police violence. So I, like almost everybody else I know that lived through these years in Brazil, was very puzzled by this. This confounded me. And not only did it confound me how this reversal happened in June 2013, we couldn't believe how much worse things got in 2014, and then how much worse things got in 2016, and then how much worse things got in 2018. And how this could have been related to the strange explosion caused by an apparent outpouring of sympathy for a radical left protest movement. And so over those years, from 2013 to 2020, every time something apparently similar started to happen around the rest of the world, right after, Turkey was happening at the exact same time, Istanbul, Ukraine starts to happen, you're in Argentina 2013, then you have Hong Kong 2014, you have something in South Korea, you have Chile. Whenever something like, seemed to be like what happened in Brazil, starts somewhere else, we all looked at these movements around the rest of the world with a mix of sort of anxiety and trepidation and fear, watching carefully and thinking, well, is it going to go the way things went here? I hope it doesn't, but I think it might. I hope it doesn't. It didn't always, but it sometimes did. But this is how I got involved in following this story so carefully from 2013 to 2019. And in addition to looking forward, I began to look backwards as well. Because I came to the conclusion that June 2013 in Brazil would not have gone the way it did if it had not been interpreted as if it were somehow like what had happened previously in North Africa and in the Arab world. So I don't think the media would have interpreted, and I'm including myself here, would have interpreted June 2013 the way we did if it were not for the error that was committed of interpreting what was happening as if it was like the Arab Spring. One foreign correspondent, and he wasn't a correspondent, one foreign commentator who was even more clueless than I was about what was happening in June 2013 said, oh, this is the Brazilian Spring. So the idea, this sort of ready-made set of concepts was grabbed and applied where I think it was not appropriate to apply them. The idea was, this is just Arab Spring in Brazil. And so it became quite important for me to understand what actually was it that happened starting in Tunisia and in Egypt and Syria, Libya, in North Africa at the beginning of the decade. So with this set of concerns, the project that I came up with for myself, the sort of insane and stupidly ambitious task that I set for myself, was to try to simply tell the story of the 2010s worldwide, to create the history of the 2010s. Now, of course, you can't actually tell the history of the world over the course of 10 years. It's not actually possible to do that. So like any work of history, I was motivated by certain concerns. I excluded and included phenomena based on what I thought was important. I organized my research and the organization, indeed, of the narrative around questions and values that I thought exist for us now in the present. I try to tell the story of the 2010s as if the most important thing to happen in that decade is the mass protest that becomes so big, it becomes something else. I act as if the most important thing to happen from 2010 to 2020 is the protest that gets so big that it either fundamentally destabilizes or overthrows an existing government. And then the question that motivates the entire enterprise is, how is it possible that so many mass protests led to the opposite of what they were asking for? And this is a very puzzling question because it's not just Brazil where things seem to go backwards. We have the strange paradox in which the 2010s are, as far as we can tell, these numbers are hard to calculate precisely, but as far as we can tell, the decade in which more people participated in protests than any other point in human history. The last time before that was the 60s, but yet, in many of the cases, the people that were there from the beginning will tell you, no, things now are worse than the thing that we were trying to fight. And so, I think the answer to that question is simply the history itself. I think it's hard to come up with a quick and easy answer for what happened. I hope that the full and rich answer to that question is the narrative that comes out of the investigation that I did, which is basically consists of putting together scholarly work on this period with 200 to 250 interviews in 12 countries. So I think that the answer, hopefully, is the story. Now, the really, really simple answer, another simple answer, is that the bad guys failed to listen to the people, and imperialism or national elites crush the people in the streets asking for a better life. But I thought, and most of my interviewees thought, that was a bit too simple. Because if the bad guys weren't bad, there'd be no reason for a protest in the first place. And back in the 20th century, for many revolutionary movements, in many theoretical traditions, it would have always been understood that there would be an imperialist backlash, that there would be a counter-revolutionary movement. So we wanted to go further than just to say, well, that they should have listened to us, but they didn't, because that's always the case when there is defeat. So the framework that emerges to help us answer this question, I think a little more namely, starts like this. At least this is my attempt at just grabbing the framework. In the 2010s, a very particular response to injustice, and that particular recipe, I think, is the apparently spontaneous, leaderless, digitally coordinated, horizontally organized mass protest, often said to prefigure the society we wish to bring about, and very almost always taking place in public squares or in public spaces. Now, all of those different ingredients come from somewhere. All of these things are historically and ideologically contingent, and I think there are both ideological and material reasons that this package, this recipe, becomes hegemon, but I think it does. And then what happens is that this repertoire of contention, starting in Tunisia and then in Egypt in late 2010 and into early 2011, is far more successful than expected at putting people on the streets. It is far, far better at getting people out than was planned for, even by the organizers often of these movements 1 or 2 weeks before the explosion of humanity came onto the streets. The people that had sort of created or at least theorized and explained why this was a good repertoire to come together often came from the altering globalization movement. They have never, I think, in their defense, imagined that this style of protest was going to get so big that it actually led to a dictator jumping on a plane and fleeing the country, or led to the police fleeing the capital and leaving the country ungoverned. Or unless, if the governments were overthrown, existing elites were so scared of losing their power that they wanted to give something to the crowd. So these protests have become something bigger than protesting. They generated revolutionary situations. But it turned out, in many, many cases, I think, that a protest is very poorly constituted to taking advantage of a revolutionary situation or taking advantage of a power vacuum, especially a protest of this type, where often consisted of millions of people with millions, if not more, reasons for being there. And so these moments of apparent euphoric victory that generated real opportunities often could not be taken advantage of, at least by the protest itself. So when there was a power vacuum, a protest of this type is very poorly constituted to fill that power vacuum instead of sort of a revolutionary committee or a transitional government or a new state. And even in cases when the government, Brazil is one of these, the government turns to the people and says, okay, what do you want? I'll give it to you. Like, what can I give you so we can go back to normal and you can have your victory and I can hold on to power and we can live to fight another day? Often, even in these less pronounced cases, the movements that had not planned to be in these situations fail to even have a mechanism for elaborating what would get them to go back home. A simple rubric that can be used is simply to look at who does fill the power vacuum. And sometimes it's national elites, sometimes it's rallying forces that are more organized, sometimes it's imperialist attackers. And sometimes it is, in some cases, people that are more or less on the same page as the original protesters, and so they take the country in more or less the direction the protesters would have liked it to be taken, but it is not the protesters themselves separate. There's always somebody else that sort of enters and imposes meaning upon this thing. But I also asked, people what they would do differently. And these answers are hard to summarize, but one attempt at doing so would be to say that many, many people said, we wish that we had been more organized before the explosion came. We wish that we had created the means for effective collective action before history came knocking, as it did outside my apartment back in June 2013 in Sao Paulo, because it was very difficult to put together that kind of a movement, put together the mechanisms for collective action in the fire of the explosion. And we watched often in horror as somebody else did. So the big lesson is you never know when there will be moments of rupture opportunity, and the more organized you are, the better you always are to be, the better situated you are to take advantage of those opportunities. And then the final point is about the media. A lot of the interviewees that I spoke with over the course of 4 years said that they believed this particular form of rebellion, this particular recipe, lent itself to the imposition of meaning from the outside, that it was very vulnerable to big media outlets showing up and saying, actually what you're doing is this. One example is in Tahrir Square in Egypt, often these movements came together through a decade of pro-Palestine organizing, and they believed by necessity, a movement for a democratic Egypt would necessarily challenge the partners of the United States in the region, that a democratic Egypt would necessarily be a challenge to Israel and the United States. And then they watched in horror as sort of like CNN and New York Times showed up and said, oh, they're doing a pro-Western uprising. They want to join America as like America's junior partner in the global order. So that's one side of it, the coin of the media critique. And then the other is that people like me, this particular type of protest, which is says so many different things at the same time, offered my class a world historic duty that I think that we did not deserve, that we should not have ever had, to come up with an explanation for what's happening, because often these movements could not speak for themselves. The task was handed to people, the people with the biggest microphones in the global system, often English language, global media, and my class failed. We did not have the intellectual or material resources required to do a good job, and often people in my class either saw what they wanted to see or said what they wanted to be happening because it would align with the interests of their audiences or their owners. And that's why I put myself in this book a little bit more than I would like to be, because the media plays a larger role than I would have liked it to play.